Over the next 20 minutes, more and more police officers arrive at the Lowell household. We instruct the kids to stay up in their rooms because we don't want them to see what's going on out there. At some point, they are going to find out that our neighbor was murdered, but I want to postpone that as long as possible. I end up making some pizza bagels in the microwave and let them eat in their rooms. I watch the spectacle through the window. Suzette comes home about half an hour after the police arrive, and I watch as a man who looks like a detective breaks the news to her. She covers her eyes and starts to sob, although to my eyes, it looks fake. She's not at all upset that her husband is dead. At some point, the police will arrive at our house to ask questions, but it hasn't happened yet. And when they do, I'm not sure what to tell them. Enzo and I sit at the kitchen table, staring down at the pizza bagels I made for us. In the best of times, they would be unappetizing. The cheese is unmelted on one side and somehow overcooked on the other side. But even if it were a gourmet meal, I wouldn't be able to eat one bite of it. "I don't understand," I say to Enzo. "What happened over there? Were you in their house?"
"No,"
he cries. "I never went inside. I was outside, working." "And you didn't hear a thing?"
"No, but you know my equipment is loud. I never hear anything inside the house."
I look down at Enzo's hands, clasped together on the kitchen table. "Where is the cut?"
"What?"
"You told me you cut your hand," I remind him. "That's why you were bleeding everywhere, remember? So, where is it?" He holds out his left hand. I don't even see it at first, but when I look closer, I notice the cut on the palm. "I'm just going to say it. There is no way that cut created that much blood."
"Cuts on the hand bleed a lot," he says defensively. "Lots of blood vessels."
"It's not bleeding now."
"Well, it stopped."
I don't know what to say. I want to believe him. I really, really do. Because when I think about Jonathan Lowell lying on the floor of the living room with his throat slashed open, I don't want to think about the fact that my husband could be responsible for doing something like that. If he did that, he is a very different person than I thought he was. Before I can formulate another question, the doorbell rings. Even though we were expecting it, we both jump. Enzo looks terrified as he grabs my arm.
"Mili," he croaks, "do not tell them about the blood on my shirt, okay?"
I shrug off his grip and get out of my seat to answer the door. I have no intention of telling them about his shirt. Wasn't I the one who told him to change it? That same detective who broke the news to Suzette is standing at our front door. He's around 40, with neatly trimmed graying hair, wearing a beige trench coat over a white shirt and dark red tie. I've met a lot of detectives over the years, and something in the back of my head tells me not to trust this one. Then again, I feel that way a lot around cops.
"Mrs. Accardi."
The detective's accent sounds more Queens than Long Island.
"I'm Detective Willard. You got a minute?"
I nod wordlessly.
"Yes?" "Can I come in?"
Willard asks. This is not my first rodeo, and that's how I know it's a mistake to invite a police officer into your house. Once I tell him it's okay to come in, he can look around. And when I think about the bloody shirt my husband just stripped off, I would prefer he didn't look around. Actually, I say, my kids are inside, so I'd rather stay out here on the porch.
If that's what you want,
Willard says. I flick on the porch light and we step outside. The mosquitoes are circling, and I wish I had spritzed on some protection, but I'm still not going to invite this man into my home. I'd rather get eaten alive.
So, I don't know if you heard
what happened, he says. He's watching my expression carefully. Whatever else I can say about this detective, he seems smart. I decide to be straight about what happened. I have a good idea. I clear my throat. I went over to talk to Suzette, and I saw Jonathan lying on the floor, and he was... I have to close my eyes, trying to block out the memory. I came home to get my phone and call 911, but then I heard the police sirens. Willard nods.
Your neighbor, Janice Archer, was the one who called them. She said she heard shouting inside the house.
Janice, of course, always watching. And she has a perfect view of the front of 12 Locust Street.
She said she saw you enter the house after she called the police, he says. Then you left shortly after.
Thank God I decided to tell the truth. Janice saw everything, so at least now she has confirmed my story. It will be nice, just this one freaking time, to not be a murder suspect.
She also told me,
Willard continues,
that your husband entered through the front door about 2 hours before the scuffle, and she never saw him leave, which means that he went out through the back door, which she does not have a view of.
My husband is a landscaper, I say. He works in their backyard a lot. It's just a job.
Mrs. Archer says that he is at the Lowell house frequently, he says, especially when Mr. Lowell is not home.
Okay. Wow. That's not... I compose myself, reminding myself that the detective is looking for a reaction from me. I'm not going to give it to him. He didn't even ask me a direct question. So, I don't owe him an answer. Mrs. Archer is a busybody. Nothing is going on between them.
Yeah, you sure about that?
I'm sure, I say tightly. Willard adjusts his red tie.
You know anyone who might have wanted to hurt Jonathan Lowell?
I didn't know him well.
How about your husband?
My husband would never do something like that, I burst out. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. A grim smile twitches at the detective's thin lips.
I just meant, did your husband know Mr. Lowell well?
Oh, my cheeks grow warm. No, I don't think so.
How about Mrs. Lowell?
The subtext in his words is obvious.
Did he know her well?
Not that well.
Even though he was over there all the time.
Working. I'm furious at myself for allowing the detective to fluster me this way. 10 years ago, I never would have let that happen. Becoming a wife and mother has made me soft.
Well,
Willard says,
maybe I better talk to your husband then. You mind getting him?
I take a calming breath. Of course. Just a moment. I return to my house and close the door behind me, leaving the detective on the front porch. I lean against the door, taking a moment to breathe in and out. Detective Willard has rattled me. When I look down at my hands, they're trembling.
I finally pull myself together enough to enter the kitchen. Enzo is still sitting there, the cold pizza bagels in an untouched pile in front of him. He looks up at me when I enter the room.
"Well," he says.
"The detective wants to talk to you," I say. Dread fills his handsome features. He's looking at me like I told him he is being marched to a firing squad. But he gets out of his chair and walks to the front door to talk to the detective. 44. Enzo won't say much to me after his discussion with the detective. I don't know what they talked about. I pressed my ear against the front door, attempting to listen. But our front door must be just as soundproof as that hidden room, because I could not hear one word. But on the plus side, the detective didn't take my husband away in handcuffs. After the detective left, I went upstairs to find the t-shirt with the bloodstains on it, but I didn't see it in the laundry hamper. I didn't see it anywhere. I wonder what Enzo did with it. We have mostly sequestered the children in their rooms, so after they finish eating, we decide to bring them both down to the living room to talk about what happened. After all, it's not like we can hide the fact that our next-door neighbor was murdered. They know something is going on. The two of them sit down on the sofa. Ada looks up at me intently with her big, dark eyes, and Nico squirms, trying to get comfortable. That kid never seems able to sit still. I also can't help but notice he is avoiding eye contact. I sit beside him on the sofa, and Enzo takes the armchair. I'm not sure which of us should initiate the conversation, but Enzo has this glazed look on his face, like he's still reeling from whatever he spoke about with the detective, so I have a feeling it's going to be me. "We want to talk to you about what is going on next door," I begin. "I assume you saw the police cars?" Ada nods solemnly, while Nico fidgets. "I'm sorry to tell you," I say, "that Mr. Lowell was... somebody killed him." They don't need to hear the details. They don't need to know about how I found him in a pool of blood with his neck gaping open. This sanitized version is bad enough. Predictably, Ada bursts into tears. Nico drops his eyes and doesn't say anything. "I don't want you to be scared," I say. "The person who did this to him, that person won't want to hurt our family. It has nothing to do with us." "Of course, we have no evidence of that. We have no idea who killed Jonathan Lowell. But I don't think there's anything wrong with reassuring two children that their lives are not in danger." "Are you okay?" I asked them gently. Ada wipes her eyes.
"Do they know who killed him?"
I can't say the words in my head, which are, "The police think it might be your father." I put my arm around her shoulders.
"They will soon. Don't worry."
Nico is leaning back on the sofa, and there is an expression on his face I can't quite read. I remember how flat he was when his beloved praying mantis bit the dust. It was disturbing. But this is a different situation. This is a human being. Plus, Nico spent some time over there doing his chores. He knew the Lowells. His brain must be a mess right now. But the truth is, he doesn't look even the slightest bit upset. We send the kids back up to their rooms. Ada extracts guarantees from both of us that we will come in to say goodnight. But Nico doesn't say much at all. I wait until I hear both of their bedroom doors closing before I turn to my husband. Do you think they're okay? He has barely said a word to me since the detective left. He still has that glassy look in his eyes. Enzo? I say. He rolls his head to look at me.
I did not kill him, Mili. You know that, yes?
I am all the way at the other end of the sofa, and I could scoot down to be closer to the armchair. But I don't do it.
I know. I cut my hand, he says. It was bleeding.
Right. That's what you said.
And, he adds, I was not cheating with Suzette.
Okay, I say. The police are already suspicious of him, based on what Janice told them. They don't even know the things I know. The blood on his hands, the way he snuck out the other night and returned smelling of Suzette's perfume. He has given me explanations for all of those things, none of which I believe. I won't repeat any of it to the police, but that doesn't mean I can forget it happened.
Please, Mili.
His voice breaks.
I need you to believe me. It's important. I did not do this.
Okay, I say. I believe you.
You swear.
I swear, I say softly. See? I can lie just as well as he can. 45. We are woken up the next morning to the sound of Enzo's phone ringing. I rub my eyes as he fumbles around to find it on the nightstand. I hear his sleepy,
"Hello?"
And then his body goes rigid.
"Yes,"
he says into the receiver.
"I can come to the station. I have to reschedule some things and..." "Yes, she can come too. We just need to get the kids off to school, but..." "Yes, okay. I'll be there."
Enzo hangs up the phone, looking about as wide awake as I have ever seen him at this hour of the day.
"That is Detective Willard," he says. "He wants us both to come to the station. To talk."
And now I am equally awake. "Did he say anything else?"
"No, that is all."
Again, I know from experience that asking us to come to the station isn't a good thing. He wants to make sure whatever we say is on the record. I wonder if they found out anything else. "I think," I say, "that we should call Ramirez." Enzo sighs.
"I do not want to bother him. And he is retired, no?"
"He said he was retiring last time we talked, but I bet he didn't." He hesitates for only a second.
"Okay, call him."
Enzo and I don't have a ton of close friends, but one of our closest is Benito Ramirez, a detective with the NYPD. I met him during a dark time in my life, when I was accused of something terrible that I hadn't done, and he went a long way to make sure that all the charges were completely dropped. We have become good friends since then, and we have helped each other out when we can. When Ada was born, we asked him to be her godfather. He's the biggest workaholic I know, even worse than Enzo. But we've spent a lot of time together over the years, and he's always had presents at the holidays and birthdays for his godchildren. Also, he's the only person who might be happy to hear from me at this hour of the morning. I select Ramirez's name from my list of contacts. Enzo keeps his dark eyes on me as I place the call.
It rings twice, and then the detective's familiar, gravelly voice fills my ear.
"Millie?"
he says, sounding as wide awake as I am.
"Is that you, Millie Calloway?"
He's the only person who still calls me by my maiden name, even though I have been a Cardi for over a decade. "Yes, it is."
"Then I'm guessing you're in some kind of trouble,"
he says. But he doesn't sound angry about it. More like amused. "We have a bit of a situation," I admit. I drop my voice, even though the only person in the room is Enzo. "We moved out to Long Island, like I told you last time we talked."
"Right. You're a Long Islander now. Are you listening to a lot of Billy Joel? Going to dinners every night?"
"My neighbor was just found murdered, Benny." That stops him in his tracks.
"Jesus, Millie. I'm really sorry to hear that. What's going on?"
I tell him the whole story about finding Jonathan dead yesterday in his house. I tell him about Detective Willard and being asked to come down to the station that morning. I start to tell him about the blood on Enzo's hands, but then my husband gives me a look, and I shut my mouth. It's not that he doesn't trust Ramirez, but, well, he's a cop. When I finish telling him what happened, Ramirez lets out a low whistle.
"Wow, that's a wild story. But they don't got any real reason to suspect you or Enzo, do they?"
"No."
"So, go down to the station and talk to them," he says. "If anything starts to sound funny, you stop and don't say another word. Then you get a good lawyer."
A good lawyer. I wonder what that would cost.
"Benny, I don't know if we can afford a lawyer right now."
"Yeah, but they gotta provide you with one. They can't question you if you say you want a lawyer."
"It will be some public defender who might have no idea what they're doing. The last time I had a public defender, I ended up in prison for 10 years. But it's better than nothing, I guess."
"Meanwhile,"
he says,
"I'll ask around and see what I can find out."
"You still work for the NYPD?" I ask him.
"You were talking about retiring."
He snorts.
"Yeah, well, I'm still here. If I had a wife, she would be furious."
I give Enzo a thumbs up. He nods and heads in the direction of the bathroom. The shower starts up, and it's only then that I blurt out, "Benny, Enzo had blood all over his hands when he came home last night." There's a long silence on the other line.
"Blood on his hands?"
"He says he cut himself."
"Maybe he did."
I shake my head. "I don't know."
"Millie," he says, "one thing I know about Enzo Accardi is that he is a good guy. I don't think he would kill anyone. But if he did, it would be for a damn good reason."
"That is not untrue."
"Don't overreact to this," he advises me. "Your neighbor just got murdered. Of course they're going to want to question you. The sooner they find the person who did this, the sooner it will be over."
He pauses.
"But don't tell them about the blood on his hands."
If I had a dime for every time I lied to the police, I wouldn't have to worry about mortgage payments. 46. I had been considering keeping the kids home from school today, but if Enzo and I are both going to the police station, there's no way to do that. I'm not bringing my children to a police station. My wish
is that neither of them ever have to set foot in a police station for their entire lives. Except possibly for a school trip. That would be okay, I suppose. Even Nico manages to get ready for school without much protest or fuss. They're both uncharacteristically silent while they choke down a few bites of cereal, which seems appropriate given the gravity of what happened. I haven't been walking them to the bus stop in the morning, but I do it today just to make sure everything goes smoothly. Unfortunately, Janice and Spencer are waiting at the bus stop when we arrive. Janice is wearing her usual nightgown and slippers, and it takes all my self-restraint not to wrap my fingers around her skinny little neck. This woman basically told the police she thought my husband killed a man. That's not exactly neighborly. We don't say one word to each other while we wait for the bus to arrive. And that's fine with me.
Mommy,
Nico says. It pulls on my heartstrings because he hasn't called me that in years.
Do I have to go to school today?
I wish I could keep him with me, close to my side. But that's impossible. I'm sorry, honey. I have something I need to do.
Can I go with you?
I'm afraid not. His lower lip trembles slightly. Nico hasn't cried in public in a long time, but I'm worried it's about to happen.
I'm so sorry, I say quickly, but I'll be home when you get back from school, I promise. Can I play with Spencer?
He asks hopefully. Spencer's eyes light up at the suggestion.
Can we, Mama?
Janice looks like she's about to have a stroke. I'm not thrilled about the idea either, after what Janice said to the police about my husband. Although, I'd allow it just to make Nico feel better. But that doesn't seem like a possibility.
Spencer, Janice says sharply, I told you after Nicholas was suspended from school for fighting that you were not to spend time with him ever again.
Wait, what? I barely have time to be furious with Janice for talking like that right in front of Nico, because what she just said can't be right. Nico went over to Spencer's house the day before the beach trip, and a few times since then as well. At least, that's what he told me. Nico, I say sharply, I thought Mrs. Archer said you could play in the backyard with Spencer.
I said no such thing, she barks. Did I, Spencer?
Spencer nods in agreement, eager to please. And that's when a look of guilt comes over my son's face. Janice never told him he could play in their backyard. And considering how vigilant she is, there's no way he was playing there with Spencer without her knowledge. So that means... Nico, come over here. I tug him by the arm until we are several yards away, and he dutifully follows. I drop my voice enough that Janice won't hear me. Where have you been going when you leave the house?
Nowhere, he says quickly. I've just been playing out on the street, alone.
Except if that's all he was doing, why did he lie about it?
I just wanted to be alone, he adds. I didn't want you to worry.
I don't believe him. There's something more to this story that he's not telling me. But at that moment, the school bus arrives, and this time, Nico is only too eager to climb aboard. I watch as the bus carries my children away, wondering if I will ever get answers to the questions swirling around my head.
47.
Even though I knew it was coming, it's unsettling that the first thing that happens when we get to the police station
is that they put me and Enzo in separate rooms. Of course they want to separate us. They don't want us to be able to coordinate our stories. It makes sense, but at the same time, it gets me panicky. The fact that they feel a need to separate us makes me think that they're not just questioning us as next-door neighbors of the victim. They are considering us actual suspects. I sit in the poorly lit interrogation room, squirming in one of the uncomfortable plastic chairs. I imagine my husband sitting in a similar room somewhere else in the station, and I wonder what he's thinking. He has barely spoken to me since the phone call I made this morning. I didn't tell him that I admitted to Ramirez that he came home with blood on his hands. My other piece of evidence that we might be in trouble is that Detective Willard himself is the one who saunters into the room to talk to me. He didn't send one of his minions. He wants to talk to me himself, personally. That's not good.
Mrs. Accardi.
He drops into the seat across from me. He has bags under his eyes, and the lighting in the room almost makes them look like bruises.
Thanks for coming by.
No problem. I try to sound as much as I can like a woman who isn't scared that she and her husband are being accused of murder. We just want to find out who did this to Jonathan. It's so awful. He seemed like a really nice guy.
Don't worry, Willard says. We're going to find out who did this.
Why does it sound like a threat? Am I a suspect? I ask.
No,
he says without hesitation. Despite everything, I feel a flash of relief.
You were at work until 30 minutes before the body was found. Mrs. Archer saw your car pull up to the house, and she said you were in the Lowells' house for only a couple of minutes. And this was after she had already called 911 because of concern of a disturbance. So, no, you were not a suspect.
He adds,
I can see why you would be concerned, though, given your history.
I shouldn't be even the slightest bit surprised that he knows about my criminal history. I would have lost respect for any police officer in this situation who didn't. But it always feels like a slap in the face when someone brings it up. Yes, I say tightly.
Mrs. Accardi,
he says,
what do you know about your husband's relationship with Mrs. Lowell?
The Lowells are our neighbors, obviously. I lift a shoulder, trying not to let my nerve show. He was helping her with her backyard in exchange for referrals. They were friendly.
Did you ever suspect anything more?
No, never. He flashes me a conspiratorial smile.
Never? Not even a little bit? Especially when he was over there all the time? I mean, Suzette Lowell is a very attractive woman.
My jaw tightens. I said never.
I see.
This detective is not going to trip me up. I'm too smart for that. He is not dealing with a rookie.
Mrs. Accardi, he says, did you know that your husband recently purchased a gun?
My mouth falls open. A gun?
That's right.
He is watching my expression.
He withdrew $1,000 from your joint bank account and then used some of that money to purchase a firearm, illegally. But we have contacts.
My heart is slamming in my chest. It's hard to imagine it could be true, but I can't deny the money was missing from our account. Enzo claimed it was to replace broken equipment, but if that's all it was, why wouldn't he have told me about it? But then again, so what if he bought a gun? I mean, I'm not thrilled about it, and I'm most definitely wondering where it is right now, and what he intended to do with it. But Jonathan Lowell was not shot. He was stabbed. So whether Enzo bought a gun or not, it's not the murder weapon. Also, Willard adds, did you know that he checked into a motel with Suzette Lowell 4 nights ago? Now I feel like I'm going to choke. I suspected that when Enzo told me he had just gone out for a drive, that he wasn't being honest. But this information floors me. I desperately want to believe that the detective is making it up just to shake me up. But everything he is saying fits. The missing money, Enzo's disappearance. Willard doesn't even wait for me to answer his question. He got all the information he needed from the look on my face.
Mrs. Accardi, he goes on, you and your husband, your financial situation is not great, is it?
We're doing fine, I say defensively.
So you didn't recently bounce a check?
Oh my God, this detective knows everything. I squirm in the plastic chair, wondering if he knows what color underwear I'm wearing right now. I wouldn't be surprised. That was a miscalculation, I say.
Do you know, he says, that Jonathan Lowell had a substantial life insurance policy and Suzette Lowell is the sole beneficiary?
Again, I am trying not to react. No, I did not. But I'm not sure what that has to do with me or my husband. He raises an eyebrow.
Don't you?
I take a deep breath, remembering what Ramirez told me to say if the questions start going in the wrong direction. I might not be a suspect, but I'm pretty damn sure that my husband is. Detective Willard, I say, I am not answering any more questions without a lawyer. 48. The detective decides he doesn't have any more questions for me. But the same is not true for Enzo. I wait in the station for him, and they keep him there for hours. I doubt they're questioning him the whole time. They're just trying to wear him down and sweat the truth out of him. I'm sure he has asked for a lawyer too, and that will have taken time. He finally emerges 3 hours later, looking exhausted. There are circles under his slightly bloodshot eyes. His lips are turned down, and he looks like he wants to throw up. What happened? I ask him.
We go, he says. Now, please.
We took my car to the station, which turns out to be a good thing because he does not look like he's up for driving. And I am slightly terrified of driving his truck with its stick shift. He climbs into the passenger seat beside me and stares out the window. I wonder what they said to him in there. He's quiet for the first 5 minutes of the drive as he watches the streets zip by. Finally, he says,
Mili, you know I did not cheat on you with Suzette?
I grimace. I don't want to have this conversation right now because between my prior suspicions and everything I heard from Detective Willard today, I can't imagine how Enzo wasn't cheating on me. And if he says otherwise, it's all a bunch of lies.
I would never.
He turns away from the window to face me.
I swear to you.
I remember Ramirez's words from this morning.
One thing I know about Enzo Accardi is that he is a good guy. I don't think he would kill anyone, but if he did, it would be for a damn good reason. I want so badly to believe that, but he's making it very hard for me.
So, why were you at a motel with her? I ask.
I was not. The detective told me is not true, he insists. Enzo, I say. I smelled her perfume on you.
He's quiet again, absorbing this piece of information. I glance over at him as I pull over to the side of the road, not wanting to crash the car while we have this conversation. He looks like he's turning things over in his head. Is he going to confess everything? Do I want him to confess everything?
Okay, he finally says. I checked into a motel that night. Is true.
I didn't realize until that second just how badly I had wanted him to deny everything.
I see. But not with Suzette, I swear to you. They only know it was a woman and they assumed.
What?
So who are you cheating on me with then? I snap at him. Not cheating, he says firmly. It was Martha. Suzette gives her leftover perfume, I think. Or maybe she might take it.
Martha? Our cleaning woman?
He nods slowly.
Okay. Of all the people I would have thought my husband might cheat with, my 60-year-old cleaning woman was at the bottom of the list. Of course, he is claiming he didn't cheat. But if he didn't, why was he at a motel with her?
I went over to her house to give her last paycheck, he begins.
I clench my teeth, remembering how I asked him not to do that, and yet he did it anyway.
Okay. And she had...
He touches his hand to his face.
Bruises everywhere. I had sensed it when I spoke with her before, but that day was when I knew. Her husband... He took her whole paycheck, and that's why she was stealing things, to save up enough to leave. It would have killed her, Mealy. Plus, he was angry she got fired from another job. I needed to help her get away.
Enzo would never lie about that. Never. If he says Martha was getting beat on by her husband, it's the truth. Or, at least, it's the truth as he believes it.
Maybe she was manipulating you to get money, I suggest.
No, he says. Is real. In fact, he stops talking, as if unsure if he should tell me anything else. But this is not the time for holding things back.
What? She wanted to talk to you, he sighs. She knew about you.
She did? I wonder how she knew. I wonder who told her. The thing is, I have a bit of a history with women like Martha. Women who are in terrible situations and have no way out. I became the way out for some of those women. So did Enzo. I have to say, I can't help but look back on it all with pride. We have done some good things in our time. Some bad things too, maybe, along the way.
Yes, and she was trying to work up the courage because she wanted your help. But then you accuse her of breaking things and then you say she is stealing. She was stealing. I told you why.
He shakes his head.
She did not take much from us. Suzette thought she was stealing too. And that is what she was talking to me about that night in the backyard.
I had to convince her there was no stealing so Martha would not lose her job. I can see in his dark eyes that every word of what he's saying is true, and I feel a stab of guilt. Martha wasn't staring at me because she meant me harm. She was staring at me because she thought I was her only hope for escape, and she was working up the nerve to ask for my help. What has become of me that I wasn't able to see that? So, I say quietly, you're telling me the gun was for her? She needed it until I could get her away from him. And after she left, she needed it even more. It was coming for her, merely. I had to help. She's hundreds of miles away right now, but he could still find her. Okay, okay. I grip the steering wheel tighter. I understand what you did. I can't say I wouldn't have done the same, but why didn't you tell me? You know you can talk to me about stuff like that. I mean, we used to be a team, right? We used to help women in trouble all the time. It was how we got to know each other. It's the reason we fell in love in the first place. I could have helped. I would have wanted to help. Why did he leave me out this time? He's silent, measuring his next words. I was worried about you. Worried? You have so much stress. Your blood pressure. Oh my God! I hit the steering wheel with the palm of my hand. So you would rather I wake up during the night wondering where the hell you are? Do you think that was good for my blood pressure? He lets out a long sigh, dropping his head back against the headrest. I messed up. I was stupid. Yes, you were. But you believe me? Yes, I say. I do. For the first time since leaving the police station, he manages the tiniest of smiles. Okay, this looks bad. Janice's eyewitness testimony puts Enzo squarely at the scene of the crime. But Ramirez is right. My husband wouldn't kill a man over nothing. If he says he didn't do it, then I believe him. Although, deep down, I still get the feeling there is something he is hiding from me. 49. When I reach our cul-de-sac, there's a black Dodge Charger parked in front of our house. Before I even look through the windshield at the driver, I recognize it as Benito Ramirez's car. Sure enough, the second he sees us pull into the driveway, he steps out of the car, clutching a cup of coffee. He waves to me as I get out of the car. Even though it's hot out, he's wearing a black suit jacket and a tie loosely knotted around his neck. When I first met him over a decade ago, his close-cropped hair was salt and pepper, but now it's mostly salt. Millie, he comes over to me to give me the obligatory hug and kiss.
Good to see you. You look good.
Thank you, I say, even though I'm sure I look exhausted. When Enzo comes out of the car, Ramirez says to him,
And you look like shit, my friend.
Thank you, Enzo says. I feel like it. Ramirez jerks his hand in the direction of our house.
Come on, let's go inside. I've got a few more reasons for you to feel like shit. You need to hear this.
Oh, God. What now? We lead Ramirez into the house. Under other circumstances, I would have felt compelled to give him the grand tour, but none of us are in the mood for that. Still,
He looks around and nods approvingly.
Nice place you got here. Better than the Bronx.
I'm sorry we left, I say.
How are the kids?
Very good, Enzo says, which I suppose isn't an outright lie. We settle down in the living room, and I can't stop shaking, wondering what the hell Ramirez is going to tell us. I offer him coffee, even though he's already holding a cup, and he smiles at me sympathetically.
Okay, let's cut to the chase.
He drops his cup of coffee on my coffee table and leans forward on his elbows.
Luckily, I got a contact here on the island, and I did a little digging. You two were right to be worried. Willard is a tough cop, and he thinks you killed Jonathan Lowell, Enzo. He's busy building his case right now.
Based on what? I say.
Well, Ramirez says, not to be crude, Enzo, but he thinks you were doing Suzette Lowell. He thinks the two of you conspired to off her husband to get his insurance money. She recently increased the insurance payout, and we're talking a lot of money right now.
That is ridiculous, Enzo mutters.
The lady across the street,
Ramirez says,
is singing like a bird for the police. Not just that, she took pictures.
Pictures? I gasp.
Uh-huh. Nothing outright incriminating, but lots of them at different times, standing a little too close, if you know what I mean.
Suzette was so right. Janice is such a busybody. Enzo groans.
We were just talking.
Ramirez arches an eyebrow.
About what?
Nothing. Gardening stuff. Problems with her cleaning lady. The weather. It did not matter. She always had an excuse for me to stay. I get the feeling. I do not know. She did not seem happy in her marriage.
Do you think the husband was beating her up?
No, I did not get that sense.
Was she flirting with you?
Enzo casts a worried look in my direction, then throws up his arms.
Yes, she was. Of course she was. But was nothing. Harmless.
So, here's the deal, Ramirez says. Your neighbor has pictures of you and Suzette Lowell that are very suggestive. A motel about an hour away has a record of you checking in with a woman just a few days ago. You buy a gun using cash. Suzette Lowell ups her husband's life insurance policy. Then the neighbor sees you going into the Lowell's house. And the next thing we know, Jonathan Lowell is dead.
Enzo grits his teeth.
I was in the backyard the whole time. Suzette wanted to plant a garden, so I was getting the soil ready.
So, you expect me to believe that not only did you not hear what happened in the house, but the actual killer went in and out the back door without you seeing?
I had equipment going. Very hard to hear, and I was back and forth from my own yard.
Come on, Enzo.
Ramirez levels his gaze at my husband.
You can be straight with me. Did you kill him?
Enzo drops his face into his hands.
No, I swear, Benny, I would never.
Then you're going to need a really good lawyer.
Enzo punches his fist into the sofa in frustration, and I don't even blame him. A good lawyer? We don't have any money. We can't afford any lawyer, much less a good one. We will have to take whoever we can get for free. The court-appointed attorney is going to have to be good enough.
We don't have much money, I say to Ramirez. So getting a really good lawyer is off the table.
I thought you might say that,
he says.
So I took the liberty of reaching out to a public defender who is one of the best I've seen. She's based in the Bronx, so not in this jurisdiction, but we can pull some strings to make it happen. She's young, 2 years out of law school, but really sharp. She has a great winning record, and she's had a couple of murder trials that both went her way. When I told her about you, she was eager to help.
That's great, I say.
She's on her way over.
Ramirez looks down at his watch.
If she hasn't hit traffic, she should be here shortly. And then you can fill her in on all the details.
He gives Enzo a warning look.
You tell this woman everything. No bullshit.
Never, Enzo agrees. I shake my head. That's so nice of her to make the trip on such short notice.
She moved a few things around, she said.
I narrow my eyes at Ramirez. Something about this seems a little fishy. This woman is apparently an amazing public defender, and yet she's willing to drop everything and drive all the way out from the city to Long Island to help some couple she's never even met? Who does that? I look over at Enzo, whose expression is equally skeptical. There's something going on here that I'm not aware of. Ramirez reaches into his pocket for his phone. He reads the message on the screen, then swivels his head to look out the front window. A blue sedan has pulled up in front of our house.
That's her,
he says. I lean forward in my seat to get a closer look at the woman climbing out of the vehicle. She has white blonde hair pulled back into a French twist and a trim build. She looks wispy, not the kind of person you would think would be a shark in the courtroom, but looks can be deceiving. If Ramirez says she's good, I trust him. Ramirez leaps off the couch to let her inside. I rise to my feet as our new lawyer enters the living room, clutching a briefcase. Enzo stands up as well, and I hear the sharp intake of his breath.
Oh, dear,
he gasps. Our lawyer isn't just any public defender. Enzo knows exactly who this woman is. And a moment later, so do I. 50.
Cecilia! Enzo cries.
The second he says her name, I know exactly who this girl is. Cecilia Winchester. I used to sort of be her nanny a while ago. And Enzo also looked after her while some other stuff was going on in her life. I haven't seen